This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. Cinema and television, when done well, help us to suspend disbelief, to forget the present and its stresses so that we can lose ourselves in the story, if only for a short time. Quite often, the actors, directors, screenwriters, and set designers receive the kudos, but a critical part of the team, sometimes overlooked, is the person or people who find just the right actor to fill any particular role. This hour, we talk about the art of casting. Our guests include Richard Hicks, casting director and president of the Casting Society of America. Welcome, Richard. Are you live with us, Richard? Richard
Hicks? I am. Can you hear me?
Sure can. Welcome to the show.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
Pat Moran is with Pat Moran and Associates in Baltimore. Pat was responsible for casting HBO's The Wire and Veep. Hello, Pat.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thank you. And here in studio with us is Diane Heary of Heary Casting, based in Philadelphia. Her projects include helping to cast Silver Linings Playbook and the films of M. Night Shyamalan. Hello, Diane. Great to have you here.
Thank you.
So let's start off with the basics. Characterize what you as a casting director bring to a film. Diane?
I think what our main job is to help fulfill the director's vision of the project. And so many times it involves, you know, meeting with the director, discussing, you know, what he sees the roles to be. And then our job is to help filter people and direct him to the right places of who we think is going to fill those roles and really bring some interesting choices to the project for him or her.
Pat, how does the auditions process work?
Well, it depends on how it works. Basically, I, much to the chagrin of a lot of actors, I like to do a cold read, and that means that they get the material pretty much when they come in, and sometimes they're wise. They come in, you spend about a half an hour with it, because I will then tell them what has gone before and what happens afterwards. I feel that way, that never can a director or a producer or writer be lulled into a false sense of security in the fact that they can put this down absolutely perfectly and then maybe not so much the rest of the material. So that's what I do, and I know that it's not the actor's favorite, but it always works for me.
So, Richard, do you believe in the cold reading, too?
I like to give actors a chance to prepare because I feel like particularly with the bigger parts. I mean, with the supporting parts, sometimes what you're looking for is who they are as people as much as how much they can transform in a role. But with the leads, often it's trying to get every ounce of nuance and substance in a role, and that I think takes introspection from the actor and requires, you know, like a lead time so that they have time with the material and can actually, you know, like give it their best shot.
So how do you find people? Do you have a stable of actors that you go to immediately? Do you put out a casting call, Diane? How does that work?
Go ahead, Richard. All means possible. It depends on the role and depends on the kind of scope of the project. Like, we as casting directors over the years have seen, you know, hundreds of movies and television and plays, and, you know, we're always looking for at acting and always looking for, you know, more information about who's out there. So you kind of build up an internal database of who you respond to and who might be right in a particular role, and you get a kind of essential nature of people. And then often you put out, when you're casting a film or a television project or a play, you put out a breakdown to the agents in the community saying, you know, here's what we're looking for, and it needs to be between this age and this age, probably. This after we've all talked with the director and kind of tried to figure out how to talk about the role so as to get the kind of the right people to put themselves forth. And then we put out a breakdown, and then we do like a ton of what we call pre-reads, which is auditions for the casting director, so that we can then call that group down and show that to the director, so that with the whole point being to maximize their time, because they hire us to make the process efficient and to find the right actor for the role in the time allowed so that they can go off and spend more time creating the movie.
Diane, how many people might read for one particular role?
You know, it really does depend upon the project because and the scope of it. If it's, you know, something more generic where it's like, oh my God, that's a great role, and I know 20 people who'd be fabulous for that. We might bring them all in to give them a shot and then whittle it down from there. But then sometimes if it's very specific, like we just finished a feature here in Philadelphia, and it was a boxing movie. So essentially, a lot of the guys in it had to know how to truly box. Well, that filters people right there. If you have true boxing experience, and so a lot of people who said they could box and they really couldn't. So, you know, so we were looking for guys who really have, you know, boxing records in the ring. And
were you talking about extras?
No. Oh no, these are principal roles. But, you know, we needed that reality. And that's a real trend that we're seeing, is very much reality in filmmaking. You know, if it's like in this film, for instance, you know, we wanted real boxers and real trainers and the real cut men in the corner of the rings. It's one of those instinctual things that it's tough. You can't teach an actor to know that in 3 days. You know, it's so they want somebody who's been doing this their whole life. It's part of their being. So many times on those kind of roles, we end up going out into the community. We're not really looking for actors per se. We're out looking in that real people. So we were out at the various boxing gyms in the area, knocking on doors and meeting people that way too.
And when you're knocking on doors, do people believe you are who you say you are?
Sometimes, many times not. We usually, you know, give them a card and say, look, we're real. Look at our website, check us out, and then call me back, because, you know, they don't believe me. But yes.
Pat Moran, how much does a role does an actor's established name play a part in securing a role? And when can stardom prove a distraction in a film?
Well, I mean, there's many different thoughts on that. Oftentimes, if you have what is called a bankable star, somebody can land a big star for a project, that project will get a green light. Then there's smaller ones where you have to find, which are the ones, of course, we prefer, that we find them. Because, number one, when you're looking at the project, the finished project, if you know that so-and-so is in it, you know he's either the good guy or the bad guy. If you have a lot of unknowns, you have to figure it out. So it's totally different, those two elements, I think.
Have you ever had to turn anyone down because they were too famous?
I don't think so. Have you, Richard? Richard would probably
would say,
be better
well, you
with
know,
that.
Kind of like, yeah, a little bit, because like sometimes you want that moment to kind of go by as part of the reality of the movie, and and if it's a super famous face, they might be a friend of somebody and might actually do it, but it's all about trying to figure out how to tell the story the best so that people are, you know, interested and creatively engaged as they listen to them, as they watch the movie or the TV show. So sometimes, you know, a big name in a part is kind of a speed bump in the road, you know, because like you're like, wait a minute, who is that? Why shouldn't I be paying more attention to them? Where'd they go? When when that's not what the moment calls for.
And Diane Harry,
we did have an incident like that a couple years ago. We had a fairly well-known actor, his agent called and, you know, he really be great in this. I said, yeah, but it's only two lines. Oh, he wants the part. And then we had to, you know, discuss it with the director and say, you know, we felt he's a distraction to the scene. And you know, he was in and out for that one little scene and he just pulled away from what the movie was about. So unfortunately, he had to be told no.
So when actors... go ahead, Richard.
Sorry. I have a friend who cast Breaking Bad, and she said she was telling me, like, a lot of times, you know, because it was such a popular show, super fancy people would want to be on it. But, you know, trying to find a place for some, you know, super fancy actor in that world, just it'd be like, well, what are you doing in the trailer? You know, like, what are you doing? What are you doing in the meth lab over there? It just didn't fit. And that's the point of casting, is to make it fit so it seems seamless and awesome so that people, you know, go to see it.
If an actor does not have an agent, can they get through to you? And if they do, how do they do? Do they send you headshots? Do they send you auditions?
It's all changing so much with the world of electronics, don't you find, Diane and Richard? Since all that came in, that's a whole different ballgame. You can have agents submit, but as a, I think all three of us have been in this game for a while, we also know when I read a script, and after we've had the conversations with the writers and with the directors, etc., when I read a script, I see somebody. I don't know about you guys, but I'll see somebody or a type, and then sometimes I will go against that type. A role, say, like in Homicide: Life on the Street, a role called for the role of Barnfather, a 50-some-year-old white guy to play a colonel, what wound up being a younger black guy that did, because Tom Fontana, who was the showrunner, it was okay to submit. You know, they gain confidence in you, so you can always put something in there that you can mess around with gender, race, etc., I feel. And oftentimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't. But yeah. Usually when I'm reading a script and I know what they do, what they don't want, I can see somebody, you know, I can see. And certainly it's always seems to be that the theater actors that often don't have agents, you know, young folks coming up through the theater, I mean, they got to go start somewhere. And might as well be with us.
And it's a different form of performing, Diane.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Okay. Yeah. We tend to, you know, we use agents as well as a lot of people without actors, because as casting directors, we represent the producer and the director. Yep. We don't get paid by the actors. We don't get any commission from them. So our allegiance is to the project and finding the best person for the project, no matter where they're coming from, with or without an agent. You know, are they Joe Schmo off the street? Are they famous actor from here? If they're right, they are right, no matter where we're finding them. And because of that, you know, like our office, we have an open call where we meet new people. We're always out, you know, going to theater and, you know, seeing improv companies, and because that's our job, is to be finding those new faces. So we're always out there looking.
What is the it factor? What do you got? I remember watching years ago, seeing Mystic Pizza and seeing Julia Roberts for the first time and just being struck by her persona. Can you describe the it factor, Richard Hicks?
It's funny, that question, because you know it when you see it. I think it's kind of a combination. There are some people who, when they think and feel, you can feel along with them. You can see it along with them. And that is a big part of what makes an actor, you know, accessible to an audience. Like when we were doing Gravity, Sandra Bullock, you know, in that part, I think one of her primary skills is that as she feels something, the audience feels something. So she can take you where she wants you to go, and I think that's a big part of it. It's, you know, sometimes people just catch the zeitgeist, and you know, and there they are, and people are interested in what they're thinking and feeling, and.
Richard, hold that thought, because we're up against a break. We'll continue with that just a moment. 888-477-9499 if you'd like to join the conversation. This is Radio Times. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about the role of the casting director in creating successful films and television shows. Our guests this hour include Diane Heary of Heary Casting, which is based in Philadelphia. Pat Moran is with Pat Moran and Associates in Baltimore. And Richard Hicks is casting director and president of the Casting Society of America. If you've got questions, if you've got comments, we'd love to hear from you. 888-477-9499 is the telephone number. Our email address is radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet works as well, @WHYY Radio Times. So going into the break, we were talking about the it factor. And Diane Heary, off mic here, you were telling me that, you know, a person can have the it factor. You can really strike a casting director, but that doesn't necessarily morph into success.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, so there's many times somebody comes in and you see it, and it is this indefinable moment that you just go, wow, this person is striking, and they get it, and there is a magic about what they are in front of the camera. But many times I've seen actors who have that, but they do not succeed in the industry for other factors. They have issues, you know, other issues that get in their way, or they get in their own way. They become, you know, the person who's not dependable, or they, you know, they don't show up on time, or they have personal issues at home, or they choose the wrong role and end up going in the wrong direction. So, you know, there's so many other factors that make somebody famous and, you know, a celebrity and a big star. And many times, you know, I see so many talented people who don't make it, per se, because they have those other factors that get in their way.
So what does it take to make it as an actor in film or television? What do you like to see?
Talent.
Being on time?
Talent is it. That's the primary function of all of it. But I think so many times it's, you know, talent is a big factor, but then there are the other factors that being a business person about this business also contributes to your success. And many times people lose track of that. All they see is I'm fabulous, and they don't realize they have to deliver as a business person as well.
Pat Moran.
And Diane. I also think a lot of times that you can. I always simplify it by saying all you have to do is to make me believe that this playwright's words belong to you. That what you are saying, I believe you would say. And also, I think that actors need to know, and certainly in our case, I imagine with both of you, we number one as casting directors want to give you a job. So we want to give you every tool that there is possible, or every note that there is possible for you to get that job. Now, sometimes you can always tell, I mean, you've been doing it for so long, your ears are really your best friend here. So you can tell exactly sometimes three words out of somebody's mouth whether it works or it doesn't work. And then if you give somebody a note and they take it, that says to me, this person can take direction. Mm-hmm. If you give them a note and they repeat the same thing that you're trying to get them not to repeat, then that means that you can't take the direction, and so that's not a good thing. And like Diane said also, you know, sometimes, I mean, people do get in their own ways by believing their own hype, and I think you need to stay grounded and really remember why you're doing it, which is because you love it.
Richard Hicks, what do you not want to see during an audition?
Lack of preparation. Like I feel like to get the job, because there are a million, you know, there are a lot of actors out there in the world. You really have to do all the work necessary to be so in it so that when the camera hits you, it looks like we're watching the person in the movie, you know. And to do that takes a lot of work. You got to, you know, prepare and think about it and or be so natural to the part that you can just, you know, be much yourself in it. And when you don't, like, when you don't do all the work necessary to give it your best shot, that's what I don't like to see.
And you also have to be able to accept the word no and then move on to be successful.
It's a hard thing being an actor, because you have to really love it and go for it, and then you have to really let it go. And I think that kind of push and pull is a very hard life as an actor, because most people in their jobs, once they, you know, they have a job which lasts a long time, and actors are always auditioning and always being told, you know, no. And so if an actor who has an ability to really go for it and then really let it go is ahead of the game, because you're not spending time, upset or anxious or sad about the fact that you didn't get that last job.
Diane Heary, what is, how do you tell an actor no?
Well, it really depends on the situation. So many times if an actor's really good for the role, and first of all, understand that for us, we only look good if the actor looks good. So, you know, when we present, say, five actors for one role to the director, in essence, we're saying, you know, we believe in all of these five actors. They're all good. And now it's up to the director's vision and his taste. You know, does he like that one? But many times the decision then comes down to, well, you know, we really wanted a taller guy. or, you know, I'd rather have a redhead. Or, I'm going to give it to, you know, a friend, because I have to give it to a friend.
I don't find that much at all.
Oh, well, we've had that instance, don't you think, Pat?
What, I have to give it to a friend?
Yep.
Well, usually in that situation, that has ever happened to me, which is few and far between, that was always established prior to any auditions.
Yeah.
In other words, I have a role of blah, blah, and I want to give it to blah, blah, and then, okay, that's fine, because it's your show, basically. But usually I wouldn't audition somebody for a part unless I knew the part was available.
Right. Sure. Are people?
And I also realize, you have to realize, people that are actors do not really know the reasoning behind things, such as I may want a taller person because my male lead is 6'6". And so you may know you went into that audition and you nailed it, but the reasoning behind it, the ultimate decision, which is a director and sometimes director, writer, producer, depending upon, it's whatever their reasons are. But what the actor, I think, doesn't realize, and I bet the both of you know this, I've had people in here that were so good that didn't get the role.
Yeah,
I remember
it's always
them.
The way.
I remember them. And then when something comes up, I call them in. Ultimately, if they're as good as I think they are, they book the role somewhere.
What should actors do to continually become better? Should they be honing their craft, taking courses? If it's a long time in between roles, what should they be doing?
I think they should be doing plays. They should be doing videos with their friends. You know, it's an internet world now, and everybody can get up and do something with somebody and have something to show for it. My advice is do things that you're passionate about as an actor. Like if you love a particular kind of play or whatever, go do those things, because when you love it, you're probably going to be better. And when you're better, we're more likely to notice you. Well, and so, you know, yeah.
What are the challenges in moving from theater to film or television?
I think like you can be awesome and truthful in any medium, but like each one of them has like slightly different criteria or things that are helpful in that medium. Like for theater, it's about taking something and allowing a big room full of people into that you know moment with you. With film and television, it's about being so honest that the camera, which is a good lie detector, can't even pick up the fact that you're pretending and acting. So while there are differences, you need to like find what's true in the scene, and then kind of be in that, and then you're more likely to get it in either medium, I guess I'd say.
Diane Heary, are people still discovered on the street or in the pizza shop or scooping ice cream?
Not that I know of. I haven't heard that happen in a while.
I have a good story about that. We speaking of ice cream, we discovered Nikki Blonsky, who was the lead in Hairspray.
Oh, yes.
She was working in an ice cream store. We didn't go to the ice cream store to ask her to audition, but she sent in a self tape, and she'd never acted in film and television. Only did high school theater before, and she got the lead in a Hollywood movie.
Huh. Was it a hard transition for her?
You mean after she got the part?
Yeah.
Or do you mean to get the part?
Well, no, after she got the part, if she hadn't done much except...
No, yeah, she worked. She did a TV series. She's in New York. She's just doing her thing. I think she was helped by the fact that she had a strong family and something to ground her. Because like when some big Hollywood production comes in and kind of scoops up an unknown, it takes a kind of good character in the person to kind of not believe the kind of glitter of it all, and to be able to stay grounded. And the things that ground an actor are their talent and their personality, if you will, and their character.
And their ability to deal with pressure, right, Pat Moran?
That's true.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of Nikki, we found Ricky Lake for the original Hairspray, who was set to go to work at the Gap the next day. And she was like in community college, and pretty much with Ricky, it's what you see is what you get. And so she's outgoing and whatever. She had never really done too many things. I think she had done some stuff maybe in high school or whatever. But she adapted like a duck to water. It was almost like that production, all those young people went to a summer camp, except it was a movie. Mm. And it was a movie with a small budget, so it wasn't like, you know, it was what it was. But she was headed for the Gap the next day. And so you never know. And those are specialized. Those are specialized cases.
The exception rather than the rule.
Yeah. And then there are actors sometimes that have been around for a while, have been in theater and done this, that, and the other thing. And all of a sudden, in the middle of their life, they hit something. And they become, those people usually can handle it a little better because they're so used to not having to handle it. Yeah, you know, young people can be seduced by it, I think. Well, and they really have to have good people around them, I think.
We'll get into that a little bit more in just a bit, but we've got an email from Pam who asks, how does a movie get terribly miscast, and can the director stop production and change actors, or is the actor locked in? Diane Heary?
Oh, wow. You know, I guess, fortunately, I don't think there's been that many cases where they've had, you know, things were so horribly miscast that they shut down and started over again. I'm sure there are a couple of cases of it, but there's so much money on the line.
Absolutely.
That they're, you know, those kind of mistakes really get avoided. And I would think that they just would continue on with who they have.
Yeah.
Knowing because that's who they
committed. That's what you have pre-production for also, yeah, to work a lot of those kinks out. So there's a certain amount of pre-production with the interaction of the talent with your director. And certainly a director can smell trouble that wouldn't occur like the day he stepped on set. I would think that there would be inclination or some kind of clue that this may not be working out. Now, then they can change before they roll camera.
Okay.
I seem to remember some story about Back to the Future, wasn't it? Which used to have Tom Cruise, and then it ended up having Michael J. Fox in it. You know, it's not that Tom Cruise was wrong for the part, but when they recast the part and found that it was, you know, found that that's when it really popped.
Right.
But they hadn't started production yet, though.
I feel like they had. I may be wrong. No, I'm sure there are instances in which they've recast the part after a couple of days of you know, it not working with the actor. Yeah,
we did have The Lovely Bones where we had Ryan Gosling in The Lovely Bones until like 2 days before shooting started. Hmm. And he was replaced then, but we hadn't started shooting yet.
Uh-huh.
But are you at liberty to say what happened there?
I can't say what happened, but I mean, Ryan Gosling was replaced and Mark Wahlberg stepped in. But we started shooting on time with scenes that Mark wasn't in, and then he caught up to speed like a week later, and then we got him in.
Yeah. It can be a fluid situation.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get to a quick telephone call before the break. Jack in Haddonfield, New Jersey, you're with us on Radio Times. Welcome, Jack.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Yeah, hi. So nice to hear this program. I wanted to find out if someone wanted to get into casting and learn the craft, are there programs from the Casting Society where people could take a class?
Interesting. Richard Hicks?
Oh, that's fascinating. You should ask that because we are in the process of developing a curriculum for casting out in Hollywood. Right now, the option is to kind of try and get a job at a casting office and kind of work as an apprentice and kind of work your way up, if you will. But that's something that the CSA, the Casting Society of America, is developing. There are a few universities. Syracuse University has a course on casting, but it's such a kind of hands-on, you know, boots on the ground kind of job that I think you learn by doing. But if you are interested, we have a website, castingsociety.com, where you can register to be an assistant. And if when people are looking for help, they can post a job posting there, and there might be a way that you could get in there. Where are you? Are you in the Philadelphia area?
Yeah, Haddonfield's near Philly.
Yeah, I mean, like, I will leave it to Diane to tell me what the job market is there.
Yeah, thanks, Jack, for the telephone call.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing to break into casting, I think, because there's so many factors involved and there's so much to learn. It's not just who, you know, spotting talent. It's understanding all the union contracts.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of more business-like stuff as well as the artistic side of it.
Uh-huh.
And that's what makes it difficult for some people to, you know, to balance both as well. Same as an actor. It's that we have to be able to balance both and understand both sides.
How did you get into this, Diane?
I started as an actor myself and then was helping out a friend who was casting. And I was like, oh, I really like this. And I've found I was pretty good at it and stuck with it. And here I am.
It's a fast-paced business.
Yes, it is.
Pat Moran, how did you find yourself doing this?
Well, mine's the accidental career. I started off with independent films basically many years ago and did everything there was from production manager to AD all the way down. But it seemed like casting was what I wound up doing and never, ever thought of it as a career, you know, basically because I didn't live on the West Coast. But I will tell you this. I had an assistant a couple years ago when Baltimore was really cooking with a lot of production, Megan Lewis, and the production dried up. She moved down to Louisiana and was the first year down there, I think, was nominated for 3 Emmys and won 1 for True Detective. So it all depends on how you learn the job and how much you love it and where you're willing to do what you're willing to do for it. I mean, it's a remarkable career, hers.
Is it a lucrative career? One word answer. Yes or no? Because you're up against the break. You do it for the love of the job, right? Okay, we've got Pat Moran with Pat Moran and Associates in Baltimore, Diane Heary of Heary Casting based in Philadelphia, and Richard Hicks, Casting Director and President of the Casting Society of America. They are here with us through the end of the hour, so we'll be back after the break. 888-477-9499 if you'd like to join the conversation. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscawain. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in today for Marty Moscawain. And our guests this hour are Richard Hicks, casting director and president of the Casting Society of America, Diane Heary of Heary Casting, which is based in Philadelphia, and Pat Moran is with Moran and Associates in Baltimore. And as always, if you've got questions, give us a call at 888-477-9499. Our email is radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So let's talk about aging in the industry, and in particular women. Is it still the case that good parts tend to fade away as we age? Diane?
No.
No, Pat?
No, no. I always thought as a young girl interested in theater, everybody wanted to be the ingenue, but the best parts were written for the character actors. And I still feel a lot that certainly I feel that that happens a lot, and that there are people that just continuously work. I mean, Helen Mirren's career has never suffered, as well as Judi Dench and a couple of those other old girls. I just think that the roles are more interesting. And if you lasted that long, you certainly have some starch. Ingenues come and go.
Do you tend to see more women of a certain age overseas, say in Britain, as opposed to here in America? Is the casting a little bit different there?
I think it might be. I don't know. I think it's all together different. It's a different process to be an actor. And, I mean, there's actors and there's movie stars in America, I think.
Yeah. But I see that you see, like, the new Netflix series, Grace and Frankie,
with
Lily
Jane
Tomlin
Fonda.
And Jane Fonda.
Mm-hmm.
But that came about, I understand, because they made the show happen for themselves. I see a lot of older women, even the stars, who are creating their own projects. Because in normal run of, you know, in the regular casting, you don't see as many roles for the older women. So you see them creating their own roles. Mm-hmm. But, well, the Meryl Streep isn't hurting either. But I know she had a gap in her own career a few years ago where she did nothing for a while. And now, you know, she's hot again. So
yeah, I think Hollywood is kind of leaving money on the table by not making stories about women of a certain age. As we saw with this weekend, Pitch Perfect 2 was a more popular movie than Mad Max. Movies that good good movies and television shows with women at the center of them are popular. It's just, this is like often people don't think to make the product for them because there's some, you know, myth that it doesn't sell as well. Well, I'm not sure that's true.
I'm not sure either.
I'm going to toss a firecracker into the conversation here. How important is plastic surgery to actors as they get older?
I think it's detrimental.
I agree with you. Absolutely.
You know, like I think it buys you about 6 months of looking the same, but what you pay for that is for the rest of, you know, an actor's face is about expression, and often plastic surgery faces are not expressive, and you know it defines the actor and it takes them out of a bunch of roles that, you know, anything that happened before 1900, it doesn't look right.
No,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so on the whole, you know, go with what you got because it's the best.
Oh, I'm sorry, Pat Moran.
Oh, I definitely agree. I think it's more detrimental. I mean, in many ways, you have a face like Jean Moreau, who you can take the camera still to this day, as old as she is, put it up on her face, and she has a talking face. If you're pumped and you have two balls in your cheek and your forehead doesn't move, that can't happen. And like Richard said, it'll maybe buy you 6 months, but I find that it is totally detrimental.
Oh, I love your descriptions, Pat. We're cracking up here in the
but
studio.
It's true. I mean, there's one actress, I won't say her name, but she's had enough work on her face that she looks like Skeletor. And how, you know, how she's getting any work at all, it just boggles my mind.
There's enormous pressure. There's enormous pressure to look a certain way.
Yeah, there is. But I think the more people own what they look like, I think that is going to help teach the buying public that pressure isn't necessary.
And it's also a case where it's not like they have good surgery like Dina Merrill. They have bad surgery, and then they look like Jacqueline Wildenstein. You know, I mean, so there's two different camps there. But sooner or later, there's a close-up in your future, I would think.
Mm.
And you better be able to talk with your eyes and your face. I think it's really detrimental myself. It's awful.
Okay. Well, moving on, the lines are lighting up here in our studio. Let's go to Andy in Wilmington, Delaware. You're live on Radio Times. Andy?
Hi. Great show.
Thanks.
I was just thinking that I've always been in a rock band, and whenever we had to put out an advertisement for a new lead guitar player, the people who showed up, half of them would be completely impossible that they would ever play lead guitar, and they were just having some kind of fantasy. And in fact, they were essentially crazy. And I just wondered how much of that kind of thing happens with your guests.
Diane?
Oh, gosh. You should be a fly on the wall when we do an open call. You know, because we allow people from wherever, you know, how else are you going to get started? Everybody gets started somewhere. So, yes, we kind of like to see everybody and, you know, in the hopes of finding that gem. But many times, you know, somebody walks in the door and you go, oh, wow. Your grandmother must have told you had talent. Oh, you know, sing out, Louise. But there's...
Do people come in crazy costumes or do silly tricks?
Well, we get that. Or we just get people who just have... They don't have a grip on reality of what they are. Mm-hmm. Because as an actor, they are the product. That's what they're selling.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't realize what product they're selling. So, you know, they think they're selling and I'm, you know... on Laurence Olivier, and they're really being Bozo the Clown. You know, I mean, they don't understand what they are and what product it is they're selling.
Okay.
So it's kind of scary sometimes.
Let's go to Cleo in Glenside. Welcome to Radio Times, Cleo.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, first off, I wanted to congratulate Diane and wish her continued success.
Thank you.
Sure. And the other piece was, wanted to see if any of you are seeing particular types of people trending these days, you know, more real looking people, ethnic, or any of the above.
Good question.
Well, I think with the projects we've been doing, it's been much more reality based. They want to see people who just look real and, you know, who live in that world of what this project is. So
yeah.
If, you know, not necessarily, if, you know, we have had projects where it is the pretty people and that is the world of them. But then sometimes it is the grit of, you know, a lower class neighborhood. And then that's where, you know, they want to see that grit. They want to see those people.
And Pat Moran, you cast The Wire?
Yes, I did.
So you saw
it. We went into all those neighborhoods, basically, and I was connected with some wonderful groups of women that I have known for years and years, and we had total entree. That thing, if it didn't look right from top to bottom, wasn't going to work, despite the brilliant words that were written by Simon and the rest of those guys. You had to have that. And I think that people kind of need to know, whether it's by research or actual life, what the material is and what it's called for.
Let's talk about notoriety. Some performers, it seems, can't handle the fame. Is a certain amount of bad boy or bad girl behavior actually good for a person's career?
No.
In other words, it gets you attention.
No, not real. A certain amount. I don't know. The short answer would be no, because that's not what it's about. And you know, some people like, you know, in this TMZ world we live in, there's a culture which kind of, you know, gets titillated by it all. But it's not what it's about at the end of the day.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
If people are difficult, that is going to cost them time on set or with their project. In this game, time equals money. You will not last that long.
That's right.
Okay. Lauren in Ardmore, Pennsylvania, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
I was calling in because you were talking about all of the lacking in roles for females, and a few of my colleagues and I just got together within the last year, and I'm one of the founding members of the Philadelphia Women's Theater Festival, which is going to have its inaugural festival in Philadelphia this July. So I was curious to hear from the other guests today in Baltimore on the West Coast, are you seeing movements like this? Because it became so clear to us that this was something that had to happen in Philadelphia to create more roles for women. So I was wondering what you are seeing in different areas of the country.
Well, let's start with the West Coast. Richard Hicks in L.A.
I think it's a constantly changing landscape, and I think there are groups that are specifically designed to, you know, empower women in the artistic conversation and get them out there and doing parts and stuff. There are theater groups out here that do that. What I also like is that there's kind of like, it's in the conversation now in a way that it wasn't, say, 15 years ago, in the way that, you know, like women can, to a degree that they couldn't before, but the internet and the ability to put video out there, like you can make your own product and you don't have to wait for someone like me to, you know, help give you an opportunity. You can go out and do it yourself.
And Pat, your thoughts?
No, I definitely agree. I think I see more of a cloud, the climate changing a little bit. I see women's voices coming up more so now in terms of technical directing, producing, etc., and have quite a few friends, women friends that are brilliant producers, etc. So I think that is a trend. I think we are hearing more about it, and I think that it will just go further. However, in the end, at the end of the day, it all depends upon your talent. Whether you're the actor, you're a good producer, you're a good director, it doesn't matter. You don't get a leg up for any other reason than you can be beneficial to studios.
We appreciate the call to Radio Times, Lauren. Child actors, how are children cast? What is in store for them? What does the work look like? Diane Heary?
Wow. Children, it's a whole other world, obviously.
Yes.
Finding that child who really fits in the part, and we've done a substantial amount of children casting, and you know, many times we go out to schools, we go out looking for that child who's right, because many times more often than not we end up having to find the child as to going to an agent who represents children, because the children who are with an agent already are more commercial children who are used to having their picture taken and, you know, smile for the camera, and they're they're a little too plastic many times.
Yeah.
So it's you're better off many times finding a child who's never truly acted before, and coach them into what the role has to be. And yeah. you'll get a much more truthful performance out of that child as to somebody who's been coached his whole life into smile for the camera. Yeah.
Richard Hicks, why is it so hard, seemingly, for child actors to develop into adult actors?
I think because the demands of being an actor in Hollywood are essentially adult demands. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. To like, you know, it becomes where art and commerce meet. And, you know, a kid who is, you know, emotional and true and, you know, bright and like, you know, a little shiny penny that they are, when they try and figure out how do I use my natural, you know, gifts to make a living, that may not be true for each kid actor. And it, you know, it's them trying to figure out how the Hollywood machine works with their natural gifts. And I think a lot of kids go off the rails when they because they don't have a kind of a grounding in why they have to be an actor. You know, they kind of fell into it, but then they get kind of swept up in all the things which aren't really essential.
We did a project.
The children in film and television is really very difficult. We just finished. I don't know, Diane, if you were part of that, as a nationwide search Disney just did. They have 23 projects in development. And they mm-hmm. so we were part of that search, and we ran a bunch of kids that we got from all over the place, like lots of schools and things and people that we did know. I think that you can take. It's hard to say what the project calls for. If you have a project as intense as The Miracle Worker, it's pretty hard to find a Patty Duke somewhere, because that was remarkable. But if you have a Home Alone, you maybe could find one. And I think the problem with the whole thing with the juveniles is, did mom want to be the actor? Does the kid want to be the actor? Is somebody going to tell the kid no if he's being bratty, or so on and so forth? Yeah. I think that it's much more complicated.
Yeah, Richard Hicks?
What's the question?
Oh, we were talking about child actors morphing it. Well, I was just wondering if you wanted to play off what Pat said, but Diane here is also jumping in.
Well, I was going to say, we did a project a couple of years ago where we had a little boy, and he was cast as the lead son. He was 9 years old, and we just plucked him out of nowhere, and he was brilliant. Mm-hmm. And he was every day on set, and I had to kept checking in with the mom every couple of days and just reminding her that he's going to be, this movie's going to wrap, and he's going to go back to school. And they're going to expect him to be a normal little boy again, where he's been on set, being the center of attention, the only child on set, living in an adult world. And then all of a sudden this letdown when the movie's over. Mm-hmm. And have him mentally ready for that, because it's a huge change. And
it is. I get that post-production blues.
Yes.
So imagine a kid.
Yes.
Yeah, you're right.
So it was, you know, it was a big thing that you know, we, you know, I kept, you know, kept telling her that, because he was a very sensitive child, and it was important, and I'm glad the mom was smart enough to recognize that for him, and he was great with it, but I could see disaster otherwise.
No, unfortunately, we have to end it here. We could have gone on a little bit longer with this conversation. Thank you so much, Richard Hicks, casting director and president of the Casting Society of America. We appreciate your being with us this morning.
Sure, thank you.
And Pat Moran of Moran & Associates in Baltimore. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. I'm happy to talk to Diane and Richard.
And Diane Heary of Heary Casting, based in Philadelphia. Thanks, Diane.
Thank you very much.
When you have the chance, visit our Facebook page and podcast by heading to whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. Our producers are Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain on Radio Times. Thanks for joining us.